You can interact with us so many ways. Go to www.emsgarage.com. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com. Go to our Twitter account, @emsgarage. Or you can download us on iTunes. Just search EMS Garage. You can also call us, 303-720-6001. EMS
Garage.
You know, standing there, the car in the parking lot. Almost ran into the store with his vehicle.
Checking out right now.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm gonna 22 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. It's your weekly podcast on all things EMS. And I hope you got to join us last night, because holy cat, well, I'm taping this a night after we had the big trauma brouhaha and all of the fun things that we did in chat and on Twitter. You actually won't hear this for about a week, but you'll get at least a flavor of it if you go to episode 55 on emsgarage.com or go to iTunes and look us up. You're going to see the after show fun that we had at the basically virtual premiere party that we did, and it was a lot of fun. So joining me this week is a very intimate podcast, but I'm very excited about it because we have Mr. Kyle Bates on with us. Hello, sir.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. What have you been up to?
Oh, traveling all over the place.
Really?
Yeah.
Like where?
I was just down in Baltimore recently.
Oh, for what? Anything fun or?
In-laws.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that's
it's fun.
Yeah, that's definitely fun. And you have little kids, so I guess that's always a good thing.
Oh, yes. Traveling 7 hours with a 2-year-old. Great time.
Ooh, lots of Benadryl. Lots of Benadryl. Yeah. No, I would never advocate drugging your kids. Never. No, never. Okay, maybe once, but it's a good thing. Thanks for joining us, Kyle. And joining us as well is Dr. Joseph Clark. Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you?
Good. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and where you work and all of those things. I think this is the first time you've been on our podcast, correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, okay, I've listened to a few and they're great, but I'm honored to be on tonight.
And so what do you do and where are you from and who are you? Why should we care?
Yes. Well, I'm a PhD scientist and a professor of neurology in the University of Cincinnati, and former EMT and ambulance person. And my current research is, and main research focus, is associated with neurologic emergencies and developing technologies appropriate for pre-hospital ambulance EMS type of applications for people with stroke, traumatic brain injury, epilepsy, staticus, that type of thing. And we are, in effect, making and testing toys for the next generation and this generation of EMS.
So let me ask the really strange question. Mm-hmm. Are you looking at something we could hook up to people's brains or something and figure out if they're having a stroke?
Well, all sorts of things, yes. And I am part of a center here in the University of Cincinnati that is developing neurodiagnostic technologies. I work with another center that is based in Michigan that is testing therapeutics in the emergency room and in the ambulance. And we also work with other people and institutes like at the NIH to do the research to get those things going. So that's the general gestalt. To answer your question more directly, what we are doing right now is we are trying to get and develop the best type of sensor technology that crosses the skin and crosses the bone, the skull, and tells us what's going on in the brain. And the best analogy is we are literally making a Star Trek tricorder to tell what's going on in the brain, whether it's pressure or bleeding or ischemia or abnormal electrical activity via seizure. And there are technologies that can do that, and we're trying to make them work to be able to do the diagnosis of various neurologic emergencies.
Wow, that's really geeky and cool. I'm like salivating at the idea. So I don't know how much you can go into, because I don't know, you know, what kind of NDAs you have or non-disclosure agreements, but what is it, like a mobile brain scan? I mean, how can you figure, I guess barring a CT, I guess I never thought you could actually do something like this.
Well, yes, absolutely. So some of the public domain technology is, for example, infrared. Infrared energy penetrates the skin and the skull, and it also can be bounced back, if you will, to a sensor. And what will happen is you can determine that there's a change in oxygen, because infrared happens to hit hemoglobin and can detect if there's oxy or deoxyhemoglobin. And that is a non-invasive technology that, if targeted correctly, can tell us if there's hypoxia or ischemia or change in blood hemoglobin oxygenation. And it's just a matter of, not to oversimplify it, it's a matter of finding the right energy that crosses those two barriers, and skull is different than skin, and then comes back again and gives us information. And various frequencies and electromagnetic energies will give us that information. And we're trying to apply them to, again, stroke, TBI, epilepsy, that type of thing.
Sorry, I thought Kyle was going to talk.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm looking at this, and or not looking at it. I'm listening to what you're saying, Dr. Clark. It almost sounds like a giant pulse ox in somebody's head.
Well, to a certain extent, that's one example, and we're working on different frequencies, because if that frequency works, we already have multiple people working on different technologies that will get across the skin and skull. Another technology, as another example, is ultrasound. Ultrasound can go miles and miles in the ocean and pass through, you know, fish and ships and all sorts of things. And ultrasound can go across the skin and the skull and the brain. It's already used for things like blood flow. And we're learning you can get a lot more information with ultrasound that can tell you what's happening with the blood and blood flow. The problem is right now that it takes a lot of skill and training to be able to use the current state of the art in ultrasound for diagnostics, and we're trying to make it, in effect, idiot-proof so that it can be applied with a broader range of trained personnel, as opposed to somebody having to do 100 a day.
Now, do you ever see this in a diagnostic realm as far as being completely 100% determinant, or do you feel that it'll just be another tool in the box?
60-40, I would say.
Okay.
60% tool in the box, you know, another tool in the box, and then 40, it might be determinant. But I think a better way to put it would be there are multiple technologies. With some of what we're talking about, it will help triage in the field. Say, for example, you have a suspected traumatic brain injury patient, a football player. You're monitoring, you know, an ambulance crew is at a football game and somebody gets their bell rung, and you're trying to figure out, should they just go to the local hospital or do they need to go to a trauma center? With the right type of sensors, they could determine if that patient needs to go to a trauma center, because there's a high likelihood of hemorrhaging. Not necessarily guaranteed, just the right hallmarks. So it could help enormously with triage and filtering where patients go and what type of management they need.
What type of sensitivity are you looking at compared to, like, traditional assessment models such as the Los Angeles Stroke Scale or Cincinnati?
Truthfully, we're not that far along as far as sensitivity, but we're working on trying to make it fast and objective. With some of the stroke scales that are out there, there's a bias with the people who are performing the tests. So we're trying to make it as objective and reliable as possible.
So do you envision this as only for hemorrhagic stroke, or will it be for ischemic stroke or ischemic head injury? I guess that would be a better way to term it, is ischemic head injury or ischemic stroke versus hemorrhagic.
Well, certainly differentiating in the field hemorrhagic stroke from ischemic stroke is almost our holy grail, because if we could have ambulances carrying TPA and a device like we're talking about be able to say hemorrhagic stroke, don't give TPA, or ischemic stroke, and then all the other clinical indicators say that it's a good candidate for TPA, that would be fantastic, because time is brain, and the transport time and the pre-hospital care that those patients could get, including TPA, would be enormous. It would save an enormous amount of brain cells and rehab time that those patients need. Because in an ischemic stroke, somewhere between 1.5 and 1.9 million brain cells die a minute during ischemia. So it is so important to be able to get to those patients and treat them early, but you cannot treat them capriciously. Ambulance personnel, EMTs and paramedics, using the LA stroke scale and Cincinnati pre-hospital stroke scale, the sensitivity and specificity for diagnosing stroke in general is 85-95%. But separating ischemic versus hemorrhagic right now cannot be done without something like a CT or MRI. And you can't put that in an ambulance.
Okay, could you refresh my memory, or say that one more time? How many cells die every minute?
1.5 million to 1.9 million brain cells die a minute during die per minute in an ischemic stroke.
Wow, that is incredible. And yeah. Okay, so how many brain cells does a normal person have then?
Oh, good question. More than a billion. Yeah, good. I honestly don't know offhand.
So they could essentially be losing 0.1% every, or maybe even a little bit more than that, every minute.
Yeah, again, we need to know the numerator in that, and I'm not entirely sure.
Wow, that's incredible. And so how long do you foresee this research developing into product? You know, I guess I envision someday, you know, the physio rep coming up and saying, hey, you know, not only does our LifePak 28 do everything else, but we'll also be able to determine if your patient's having a hemorrhagic or ischemic stroke in the field. You know, you just hook this thing up to their brain and it massages it and it, mm-hmm. you know, it does like beeps and whoops and tells you everything. I don't know. Maybe, I guess I foresee that in the future, but, you know, how far away are you? Are we talking years? Or are we talking, you know, decades?
No, not decades. The separation of the ischemic and hemorrhagic is tough to say. But with some of the other things, like assessing seizure and different grades of TBI, that's 5 to 10 years. We have some prototypes that can do some things that are very interesting right now. And so getting prototypes tested in an ambulance could be even less than 5 years, because you have to do the medical research to prove that it's going to work. And that's one of the reasons I'm very happy to talk to you guys, because I'm hoping that ambulance personnel will be very willing to participate in the clinical trials to be able to get these and other things on the rigs eventually, because you have to do the research in the correct setting. You can't do the research in a lab environment and say, oh, it's ready for an ambulance. So we need the engagement of the buy-in from the guys in the trenches to be able to do this research.
Do you have places in mind for this? Or Are you looking for, I'm assuming you're looking for high volume systems that can churn out a bunch of data for you.
What do you mean by high volume systems? Do you mean research systems or technology?
Just high volume EMS systems that do a lot of calls that would be available for, or at least would be available and willing to participate in some type of research trial.
Right. Well, some of those the NIH are actually already helping to develop. I don't know if you've heard of the NET, the Neuroemergency Treatment Trial. That is a network of, I believe it's 17 centers. It's hospital-based, but it has enormous outreach to the ambulance community. And this is a clinical trial network to be able to do clinical trials like we're talking about. But just because the network's set up doesn't mean it's going to work. You need the passion of the people who are doing the work every single day, and that because they're the ones producing the data and interfacing with the patients and then turning that over to the physicians and scientists to see if it's working. So right now, all I'm trying to do is beat the drum and get the message out there and keep it on the front lines of everyone's mind to enable them to at least be a little bit more open when the clinical trials start being designed. And, you have to start saying to a patient, this is a clinical trial, and I believe it's something that we need to do. And then consent a patient to participate in that trial.
Okay. Very cool. And have you guys started? So the NIH is engaging those systems. Have you talked to Denver Health comes to mind only because they do a lot in the field of research, and I always think that they're, because they're so closely tied to a hospital system that understands the need for research, and they have Dr. Pons and they have Dr. Chris Caldwell, and they have a lot of good doctors that really understand the need for EMS research. I think that they're always on the cutting edge of those types mm-hmm. of research things. They most recently did the blood replacement therapy in the field, and they've done a bunch. In fact, they're right now testing droperidol again in the field to hopefully get it unblack boxed for us, at least in Colorado. So because we're like, we use a lot of black box drugs in EMS still. So why don't we see if this is really going to cause harm or not? So I don't know if those people have come to mind or not, but I think that you should get connected with them. And if you need help, I can get you in with those people, because I think that would be a great system to at least trial it with.
Right. Well, that would be a great system and a good connection, and I appreciate if you could facilitate that. And I guess the other soapbox thing that I would want to go into is we also want to help the EMS community get ideas in the research pipeline. So if there are people listening to this or that you are communicating with who want or have an idea, but they're not sure what to do with it next, the centers that I talked about are geared to be able to do that. In other words, to help the research of people who haven't done research before, because I'm no longer riding in an ambulance anymore, so I'm not likely to see where the needs are currently. Therefore, we need the ideas to come from the people in the streets and to tell me, or I'll tell whoever is necessary, where the clinical needs are, so that we can work on future research programs together based on the needs from the people in the streets.
I've got one, and I'm only doing this because I love Will Dunn, and he would say it if he were here. You're a neurologist, and why are we doing more in the field of spinal immobilization? Like, lessening our use of it? I don't know. I mean, I'm just throwing it out there. I'm just like, hey, you ask for an idea, there's an idea.
Well, first, I'm a neuroscientist, not a neurologist. But
oh, right, sorry.
Truthfully, I don't know. I have no idea the answer to that question. But what would there be a research question in there? Do we need to do
I'm not a researcher, nor am I an educator, so everybody knows that. I'm just a talk show host and a paramedic and kind of a nerd. But I guess, you know, I don't know what the... I guess the question would be... I mean, we over... Help me with this, Kyle, because I'm floundering here. But I think we immobilize way too many people, far too many people, when there's really no data behind the reasoning why we do it or don't, and maybe the fact that we're actually causing more harm and not. Am I heading down the right track there, Kyle?
I think you are. We're actually, at least on the East Coast, we've already gotten rid of most of our immobilization. We've actually gone into selective spinal immobilization, is what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know,
okay, so Kyle, would you consider that evidence-based medicine or medical change, or an opinion to change procedure?
No, there's actually evidence behind it. One study was done in Maine with 5,000 participants enrolled into the study, and using EMTs all the way to paramedics based on, you know, a select criteria.
Right.
As to which patients should be immobilized, which ones are able to be enrolled into the study. And of the 5,000 patients enrolled, only one was found to have a cervical fracture. And if I remember right, that was some bizarre fracture that no one even... they met all the criteria to not be immobilized.
Right.
They just happened to be the one of 5,000 that fell through the cracks.
But it's all about one patient, right?
Yeah.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah. New York State looked at it, did their little study, and we're now doing selective spinal mobilization. And don't quote me on if it was an actual study or an observation, but I believe was it Bangladesh or...
Wasn't it the India study?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where they don't do any mobilization and we do.
Right, and they actually had better outcomes.
Yeah.
I know. And that, I guess my question, Dr. Clark, would be, you know, could you come up with a device that we could scan people's necks to see if they have any neurological damage or, you know, I don't know. I'm grasping at straws here. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, I think that there's opportunity in the area of neuroscience that we could take further.
Yes, I agree. I think there are multiple areas in the neuroscience, neuromedical field that need to be taken further. The statistics or the buzz phrase that's used a lot in the neuroscience community right now is neuroscience research and neurologic research and neurosurgical research right now in associated with EMS and pre-hospital and emergency department research, right now is where the cardiac world was 25 years ago. And over the past 25 years, there's been this huge emergence of diagnostics and therapeutics and monitoring and reading and treatments and intervention and surgical intervention and invasive and non-invasive and minimally invasive ways to take care of those patients. And we believe that that's going to happen. That type of thing is happening now for the whole neuro emergency community. So there is going to be an explosion of stuff. And I think spinal sensors is definitely going to be one of them. I'm working with some people now who are doing nanotechnology to help fuse the spinal cord to improve outcomes post spinal cord injury. Sensors for those patients, they're coming, but there are sensors where a micro needle can be passed instead of a spinal tap, can be passed up into the spinal column, not the spinal cord, and be used to determine if there's normal conduction and function. So those things are coming. That's one of the great things about my job, in that I'm like a kid in a candy store every day. I hear about all these cool things that are out there. And because I am working with engineers and physicians, and I'm a scientist, I can talk to the physicians and they can say, we have these needs. And I can talk to the engineers and say, we have this technology. And part of my job is to put them together. I'm like a matchmaker for medicine. It's the greatest thing.
That's all. That's a great. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Now, the question that.
It's just, I can't emphasize enough. It's just tons of fun.
Now, the question I have, you mentioned that, you know, neurology is where cardiology was 25 years ago. We're still having a hard time placing, you know, thrombolytics on ambulances. Despite, you know, 12 leads and better assessment, you know, and education, you're still not seeing that on there. Is it, do you think it's going to be easier to put on thrombolytics for stroke as compared to cardiology?
That's a great question, and I would have to say, if we had the right diagnostic, yes, absolutely. The validation of a technology to sense the ischemic stroke over the hemorrhagic stroke, because there's almost nothing else you can do. There's no supportive care, and when those brain cells are dead, they don't recover. Yes, I think the FDA will approve that, and various policymakers would approve that faster for stroke than for a heart attack, getting the lytics on for the stroke patient.
Well, and I think where your technology has so much potential is not only in the medical patient in stroke, but in a head-injured patient, too. I mean, it has a much broader application than just, you know, an EKG for a heart attack. I mean, I just see it so. I can put an EKG on and in a trauma patient and go, yeah, maybe you have a bruised myocardium and maybe, you know. But you know what? If their heart stops in a trauma, they're probably going to die. So at least in this, you can say, hey, you know, we definitely have some bleeding here. Maybe we can start some mannitol because they have some brain swelling, and you know, we can do some procedures that will really maybe help determine a better outcome in the future.
Now, the question I have, I'm going to play that devil's advocate real quick here. As a flight medic, I see a lot of head injuries. We see a lot of traumatic head injuries, and I you know, from doing the assessment, looking at the mechanism and what we're seeing, we can pretty much say, yep, he's a bleed. You know, on that, how do you think that this will change what we're doing?
For airlifting out to TBI patients?
Well, not so much. It's, you know, without using any technology now, using, you know, our traditional assessment skills and what we're seeing, you know, in terms of vital signs and clinical presentation, we can pretty much look at the patient and go, yep, he's a bleed.
Right.
How will this technology make it, how's it going to make what we do any different than we're doing now?
Oh, okay. One of the ways is if you have that bleed patient, one hypothetical scenario is if you have coupled with that a subclinical seizure activity, that is catastrophic, especially in a TBI, post-TBI hemorrhage patient. All right, is this where you're going?
Okay. Keep going.
I'll keep going. So seizure activity to the brain is like running a marathon is to the skeletal muscle. I mean, you are churning through ATP and energy at an enormous rate. And it can make cells more likely to die if they're already on the edge because of the TBI or the increased ICP or the hemorrhaging. And so the technology we're talking about can also is designed to also be able to help assess if there's subclinical seizure activity. So that would mean you might need to start thinking about Ativan or other types of intervention, depending upon multiple injuries to that patient. So the compounding sequela that's associated with that patient, that hopefully the non-invasive and minimally invasive technologies will be able to direct care, whether it's intervening in the flight or rerouting to a different hospital if you have a trauma center of choice.
You don't ever see us doing burr holes in the field.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't see that occurring.
I have my Black & Decker ready. But you know, I guess the thing is that, okay, you know, if you're having a seizure, you know, head injury, intracranial pressure or not, I'm still going to treat a seizure utilizing, you know, Ativan or Valium or some sort of, you know, drug to stop the seizure. You know, I guess I don't understand how, you know, this technology will change what I do any differently than what I'm doing now.
Well, because you might not see the seizure. A subclinical seizure, by definition, means there's no external part of the definition is there's no external motor involvement, but the brain is still firing away at a horrendous rate that can be detrimental to the cells.
Okay, and then by treating that with Ativan, if that will actually stop that intracranially or intracerebrally?
It may, and it'll certainly help. I mean, it may. I'm not saying it's the definitive treatment, but that would be one way to intervene, yes. So you were asking how it would change your current practice.
Right.
That is one way it could. And again, you're saving brain cells. The name of the game is to definitely save brain cells.
And, okay, so that is the current state of your research. Where do you see this going? What's your next steps as far as what you're going to do in your research project?
Well, coupling the diagnostics to therapeutics.
Okay.
So therapeutic options, developing the next generation of treatment strategies. I'm focusing on therapeutics because, diagnostics right now because it's, you can't be a master of everything, but in the future, I think the logical segue for what we're doing, centers that I'm involved in, will be to, when you have information, you need to have ways to use that information and enhancing the clinical armament of treatment options is one way we want to go. And I talked about ultrasound beforehand. I don't know if you are aware, there are actually several clinical trials using ultrasound and generalized ultrasound and targeted ultrasound as a clot-busting agent.
Really?
Yes. I mean, you've heard of lithotripsy, right? That's sound waves to break up kidney stones,
right,
and gallbladder stones, that type of thing. The concept is trying to be adapted to be able to break up clots.
You know, actually, I'm actually very amazed that by this time in our development in EMS, we don't have more ultrasound machines in the ambulance with the ability to put it on patients and even determine an abdominal bleed in the ambulance. I think I'm really surprised that we haven't gone to that type of diagnostic, or at least gone to that diagnostic level in the field. It seems very easy. They have them in the ER. Why can't we carry them in the ambulance? I mean, it seems like the logical next step of, you know, I saw a post on GEMS Connect the other day that said futurizing EMS. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's one way to futurize EMS and start putting us into the next century of what we need to be doing. Instead of running hot back with somebody we think has an abdominal injury, why don't we take 2 seconds on the scene and determine if they really do?
Correct. Yes. I think that... I think ultrasound is a diagnostic ultrasound is a perfect example because it's lightweight, it's relatively easy to use, and it would provide, when used, an enormous amount of information, and they can be made robust enough to be able to be used in the field. So I think they should be, and it might just take a little bit of lobbying, may be a bad word, but lobbying the companies to start targeting the ambulances because it's a solid market.
I smell LifePak 17 coming.
Oh, Jesus.
Sorry. No, well, do you ever foresee ultrasound with the actual clot busting agent ability in the ambulance, or do you think that that's more of a hospital type thing?
Um, certainly I see the first next steps are going to have to be in the hospital because of monitoring and such. And I do want to say one of the clinical trials with very aggressive ultrasound parameters actually did more harm than good. So it needs to be done carefully and appropriately. But you did say, do I ever see it in the ambulance? And the answer is yes. But that's not the five-year time horizon.
We're talking decades, correct?
A
decade or two, okay.
A decade or so, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Kyle, did you have something to say? Sorry.
No, sorry.
Oh, no, that's cool. I'm so excited about this. So ultrasound, then we have infrared, and then things you can't discuss. So on the infrared spectrum, is there anything diagnostically and treatment-wise that infrared can do, or is infrared just diagnostic?
I think right now infrared is just diagnostic, but there are light frequencies that may be therapeutic. And there is a clinical trial going on, partially in the U.S. and in Europe, using transcranial laser energy to treat stroke patients.
Nice. I want freaking lasers in the ambulance. Sorry, that's from one of my favorite movies. All I want is an ambulance with freaking lasers on their lasers. Well, I mean, I just see that light frequency would be, I don't know, good or something. Who knows? Well, what other thoughts and what other questions do you have, Kyle?
What do you think in terms of light sensitivity? Are they going to be thrown off in terms of hypotension or in cases of carbon monoxide poisoning?
I'm sorry, Kyle. I missed the first part of your question. Can you repeat it?
I'm sorry. In terms of, looking at the infrared, what's the likelihood of them being of us getting errors in terms of hypotension or in terms of carbon monoxide poisoning?
Well, certainly peripheral pulse ox is... there's a lot of experience there. So we can use the experience of others with the peripheral pulse ox to be able to minimize the noise caused by things like carbon monoxide and CO2 and carboxyhemoglobin and all that stuff. And do realize that smokers have an enormous amount of carbon monoxide hemoglobin and cyanohemoglobin. So those confounding variables, we actually are very familiar with them. Is that answering your question?
It does. Yeah, it's always something that comes up once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's noise. It is noise that needs to be dealt with, but we have strategies for being able to deal with it.
Well, anything that you see coming out recently or in the near future with stroke care and traumatic brain injury care?
Traumatic brain injury care, there's a lot going on with the military and the DOD because of the recently two wars, now more or less one war, because there are a lot of patients being airlifted kind of subacutely after an evac from a field hospital. And a lot of information is coming out from there on what are important monitoring variables. And so I think this is a prediction, so like just my best guess. I think what's going to be happening is multiple modal monitoring pieces of equipment in the neurologic patient, which will include EKG and blood pressure and urine arterial pressure and other parameters. They're not going to be raw data for much longer. I think soon they're going to be automatically massaged to be able to provide summarize data that's easier to read. So in other words, if you've ever seen in a intensive care unit or NSICU, the screens with lots of lines going on and, you know, heart rate and blood pressure and EEG and different EEG leads and such, instead of lots of different lines, they'll be summarized more coherently. And then the physicians and I think eventually paramedics will be trained to monitor them cohesively. So you won't have to read 20 lines. They'll be summarized into one or two. And a lot of that's going to be algorithm development.
Well, and Kyle has a good point. Or a good question, I want to ask it in a different way. Do you foresee in the near future new and better techniques to treat strokes versus what we have today? You know, you have the little, I know in Denver they were testing several methods. One was like the little spring-loaded thing that you would, if they knew where the stroke was, they would kind of go up there, kind of like an angioplasty or something, and they would go in there and they would deploy the spring and kind of pull out the clot like a cork. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they would go and they would actually inject TPA right on the clot and break the clot up, things like that. Do you foresee any newer, better ways other than ultrasound in the, say, in the coming, you know, 3 to 5 years that would really kind of revolutionize what we're doing today? Not only in the field, but maybe even in the emergency room or in the hospital.
Yes. Yeah. The trials you're talking about are the different device and clot retriever trials, and the University of Cincinnati is leading the interventional management of stroke version 3 trial, where those different devices are being deployed, and there is an ultrasound device in that cadre of devices. So the corkscrew device is a device that can actually pull out a clot using a neurointerventionalist. And yes, those technologies are definitely coming and definitely getting more and more advanced and robust to be able to clear the clot and recanalize arteries. And there are a bunch of them being studied right now. And I think there's been two new FDA-approved devices this year, this calendar year. So they keep churning them out, and what I think will occur is one of them is going to float to the top and be very effective, because it seems to be turning out that there's a lot of user preference for different devices, and there is no consensus that I've seen yet on what is the best device. So it really is, there's sort of vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, but there isn't necessarily the creme de la creme yet.
Now, to move away from the stroke, Dr. Clark, what about any feelings on some of the literature and studies being done with cardiocerebral resuscitation?
Yes. Do you mean hypothermia during CPR and resuscitation, trying to protect the brain during CPR and during cardiac arrest?
Everything from that to no longer providing positive pressure ventilations in the early cardiac arrest stage?
Yes, yeah, a lot is coming along those lines right now. So, for example, what we are finding is that if you have ischemia and stopped flow and then to the brain and then start flow again, that can be worse than stopped flow and wait and then prepare the brain for reflow. Does that make sense? So what may end up occurring is some sort of preservative or polygic solution or intervention before a restarting of the blood flow. The other thing is, if the choice is low oxygen and versus low flow, low flow is worse for the brain. So the ventilating a patient is often not as important as maintaining pulse, at least some sort of perfusion to the brain. So that information is helping us prioritize what should be done next. And there may be a time when certain patients you might not want to resuscitate and might want to pack on ice, so to speak, and preserve the brain until the blood flow can be restarted after giving a plegic solution to protect against what's called reperfusion damage.
That'll be an interesting change in the field.
Yeah, so that's not, again, that's not tomorrow. That's
right.
Coming along. But I think both of you have been in the field long enough. You've seen that the American Heart Association is gently changing how they teach the CPR course and how important the respirations are versus the compressions.
Well, that's true, and we were always, you know, oh, it's all about the oxygen, and now we're like, it's more about the blood.
Yes, it is more about the blood, yes. And that's actually going to change again. I think it will change again. That's just one person's prediction.
Wow. Well, your insight is definitely very refreshing, and it's neat to have a true research. We've had several researchers on of late, and it's really nice to have researchers on that understand their field and are really engaging in what they do. Now, can you give me? We don't issue any CEs for this podcast at all. Now, if your local training officer would like to issue CEs for it, let them, because you can generally get about an hour of credit. But hit the highlights for us real quick of what we should be looking for in a stroke. You know, what are some of the hallmark signs? And then we'll wrap up from there.
Research or clinical issues for stroke?
Are you clinical in nature? I guess I should have asked that at the outset. Do you have any clinical background, or other than the ambulance side? Or?
Well, I worked on the ambulance for 7 years. Obviously, wrote the book My Ambulance Education, and worked in an emergency room as well, all to pay for college. I'm a certified athletic trainer, so I worked with a lot of sports injuries as well. I do have a clinical history, but I'm not clinical anymore. I'm very much just research.
Okay, basically what I was going for is, give us, since it's based on Cincinnati, I was hoping for the Cincinnati Stroke Scale.
The Cincinnati Stroke Scale is very useful and I think fairly well established. And I think there are subtle challenges that can be used for assessing patients who have suspected stroke or TBI. And the community one that we always talk about is FAST, face, arm, speech, and then it's time to call the ambulance. Now, obviously, you know, most of the people listening would be already on the ambulance, but that is face, arm, and speech are things that stroke definitely affect. There's also things like motor drift. If there's abnormal posturing of the arms or fingers or legs, or a tendency to walk to one side, if you're walking a patient, there's a lot of information in how they're behaving. Because many stroke patients can be fairly ambulatory, because it's a progressive phenomenon as the brain cells are slowly dying. Other thing is, without question, stroke is a medical emergency. The patient is not, unfortunately, diaphoretic. They're often not even excited. They're maybe a little confused, sometimes a little sleepy. And so it can be misleading that it doesn't seem like an emergency, because we've all been geared towards a lot of the cardiac patients, you know, diaphoresis and crushing chest pain, and there's a lot of urgency there. And stroke patients are, oh, it might get better. And then what makes it worse is if the patient had a TIA, mini stroke previously, they might say, oh, this happened a couple days ago, but it got better. It might not, and that's extremely problematic.
Can you give us, and I don't know if you really, again, I'm not sure if this is your area of expertise, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. What is the likelihood that somebody that has a TIA will have a stroke within the following year? I mean, have you guys put a percentage on that?
It's huge. It's something like sevenfold higher risk of having a stroke if you've had a TIA.
Well, I will tell you that I hope that if 1.5 million of my brain cells are dying every minute, somebody will actually think that that's a medical emergency and take me to the emergency room quickly and appropriately.
Yes.
And prudently.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and I think probably one of the last points to understand is that brain tissue is a lot harder to overcome the damage than it is from, say, an MI. Because at least part of the heart can compensate and it can get stronger in other areas. Whereas once the brain cells are dead, and maybe I'm wrong. I mean, you're the scientist here, but once those cells are dead, it's very hard for that area to come back. Am I correct or no?
You are 100% correct. Yes, and I'm glad we touched on that because I kind of forgot. You can lose 10% of your heart mass, and the heart will adapt and compensate, and many patients will seem to be normal. They might not be able to still be able to run a marathon, but they will seem to be normal and functional and have a high quality of life. If you lose 10% of your brain, you might lose all of your speech or all of your left side of your body or be blind. That's substantial. There's almost no chance of having a completely normal outcome after losing 10% of your brain in a stroke. So yes, it's very hard to have reversal of that damage. There are people working on that, but that's a whole other podcast.
Oh, I was going to say, and that's a good place to stop it, because I bet we could have you back on and we could talk and maybe even bring those people on, because I assume it's probably stem cells and a few other areas. Hello? Did I lose everybody?
I'm here.
Oh, I lost the good doctor. For some reason, he just died. Hang on one second. I'm just going to pause the pod. So this is why maybe we can have you on soon and talk to other people in the field that are probably dealing with stem cells. Is that correct? Probably.
Sure.
Okay. That'd be great. Cause I think that talking about the way that people are recovering from strokes and the future of that is equally as important as what we can do to treat them at the time that they're having a stroke. We probably could talk about prevention too, but nah, that's for public health types. Well, thank you, Dr. Clark. I really appreciate you coming on tonight and dealing with my banter and my ignorance sometimes. But can we find you anywhere? Do you have a blog or do you have a Twitter that we can follow you and follow some of your research, or at least an email address where we can contact you if we're interested in doing some follow-up with the research?
Yes, to all of those. So I have a blog, and the web address is www.josephfclark, that's josephf as in Frank, clark.com /blog. And that, obviously that's my website as well. My email address is Clark, C-L-A-R-K, J-F as in Joseph Floyd, at josephfclark.com. And I'm on Twitter as Clark JF.
Okay, very cool. Clark JF. I can remember that. Oh, that's just like your email. Okay, great.
Yes, it is.
All right, follow him on all of those things. And are you going to any of the conferences coming up? Are you speaking anywhere?
Yes, I'm going to two conferences, one in China, where I'm chairing a session and giving a couple of talks. And it's on blood in the brain. And the conclusion will be it's bad. So if you're bleeding in the brain, that's bad.
I've always heard that. That's a really bad thing.
Yes.
Not a good thing.
Blood normally outside of its normal area is bad.
Is bad. That's correct. And then the other meeting is Society for Neuroscience, which is a big geek fest in Chicago this year.
Oh.
And I've got a booth and a booth for our center and a couple of poster presentations. I don't think I have an oral presentation at Neuroscience.
When is that?
The 17th to the 24th or the 21st of October in Chicago.
Neuroscience. What do you know the name of the conference?
It's sfn.org, Society for Neuroscience.
Sfn.org. Oh, very cool. And we will look them up, and I'll put all of this in the show notes. So if you have an inkling to go hang out with other really nerdy people, because I'm one of them, and it's a lot of fun, let me tell you, you will not hear better stories or have a you will come out with a better understanding of all the things that are going on and in research, and I think it's great. So, Mr. Kyle Bates, where can we find you?
Back at my website, kyledavidbates.com. Still working on a blog. Still trying to find the time to put that together. But October 18th, I'll be at Vital Signs in New York State. It's a New York State conference.
Vital Signs?
Vital Signs. It's a New York State EMS conference.
Excellent.
And are you going? I always ask you this. Are you going to Expo? No, you're not.
No. I went to Florida. I spent my vacation time for Florida.
Oh, that's right. I forget about that NAMSI thing. You educators. Well, I am Geeky Medic on all of those lovely sites, Twitter and Facebook, and you can find me there. And I thank you, gentlemen, very much for joining us. Always, as always, join us at the EMS Expo. We're going to be there October 26th through the 30th. Come on to the show floor. Talk to us. Somebody said last night in our live chat, we're going to do that live chat again. We're probably going to start that up next week. We had over 100 people in our live chat last night. It was awesome.
Wow.
Somebody actually said they wanted my autograph, and I said, you know, don't waste the pen and the paper, because, you know, it's really not worth it. And it was very flattering, but nonetheless, you could really go get Randolph Mantooth's signature or something. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so find us there, and we'll be on the show floor. We'll be doing kind of man on the street kind of stuff, talking about doing some fun interactive things, and we're also going to be taping probably in the neighborhood of what will be tantamount to torture of 10 podcasts, but it'll be a lot of fun, and you'll see us all, and we'll probably look a little haggard by Friday, but it'll be a lot of fun. And if you see Buck, buy him a beer, because he really deserves it. So thank you guys very much for joining us
thank
tonight
you.
And join us next time on the next EMS Garage, when we're going to talk more about issues that concern you.